watch him over 20 years, I did several different scripts. And in the end, I managed to get Orion to put up the money. And eventually, Orion, you know, at that time, were working through Warner's. This scene was, this opening sequence was, all posed all sorts of problems. It was obviously very difficult. Armor and horses and fighting and all at night in the mud. And we shot it at the back lot of Ardmore Studios in Ireland. And one of the problems was that the first night shooting, When we looked at the rushes, there was nothing on the film. And the cameraman's exposure meter let him down in some way. So we reshot it the following night, and to our horror, it was also completely underexposed. And the poor cameraman had a nervous breakdown and left the picture. So there we were. We'd been shooting for 2 days or two nights. We had nothing, and not even a cameraman. So I then, I'd always wanted Jeffrey Unsworth to shoot this picture. He died a year or two beforehand. I'd always talked to him about it. He was a marvelous cameraman. And so I got Alex Thompson, who was a cameraman who was had himself fallen on bad times. He'd been fired from a picture, Jesus Christ Superstar, and hadn't really had any work. He was doing second unit stuff, and I got him to do this. He did a terrific job, got a Oscar nomination. One of the problems with in that first sequence, which was seemed to end this problems, was also that I wanted Merlin to be a kind of sexless, and I wanted him to be hairless, but at the last moment Nicol Williamson didn't want to shave his head, so I went the other way and sort of made him very hairy. It just looked awful.
Behold the Sword of Power, Excalibur.
So finally, the armourer, Terry English, knocked up this little headpiece, this helmet that Nicol wears, and so it gave a kind of impression of baldness. It fits tight to his head, and he made it in about 10 minutes. Terry English, who made all this armour, I found him in the East End of London in a little back street workshop, and what he did was to make fake antique armour, which he sold to collectors and even to museums. Half the armour in the museums of the world had been made, had been faked up by Terry English, and he did all this marvellous armour. This is Gabriel Byrne's first picture. He's playing Uther Pendragon, and he had a very heavy Dublin accent. Nicol Williamson, he has a line where he says, "One night with Igraine," and he says, it comes out, "One night with Igraine." And Nicol always said it sounded like "One Night with Your Granny." That's my daughter, Katrina, playing the unfortunate creature who's... He Igraine, who gives birth to Arthur, the young Arthur, and is taken off by Merlin and hidden away. The legend, you know, there's always this, the legend of the Grail legend, the Arthurian legend, has always obsessed me. It seems to me to be central to the English-speaking nations. The power of it is that it's really in three parts. It's the early part, which is the birth of Arthur, or the Uther's, his father Uther, in this kind of brutal period where man seems to be emerging from the swamp. That's why I had all these sort of monstrous headdresses for the warriors. And then there's Camelot, which is the rise of Arthur and Camelot and civilization, and then the collapse of civilization and the wasteland, which is seems to me to represent the past, the present and the future of humanity. Here we see Uther is laying siege to the Duke of Cornwall's castle, and he's desperate to find a way to get to Igraine. And we built a lot of this huge sets we built on the back lot of Ardmore Studios, which has now been sold to as a housing estate.
You'll never battle this down, and you'll never have Igraine. Never.
Byrne, where are you?
And you know, Gabriel Byrne had a... I saw him on the stage. And he had a tremendous sort of force, which appealed to me. Nicka Williamson is an extraordinary actor. You know, I decided I wanted him to play the part of Merlin, and the executive of Orion Pictures, who had formerly been had been running United Artists, and they'd made a number of films with Nicka Williamson, that all of which had failed. So they said to me, "Look, you can cast anybody in the world you like except Nicka Williamson." So I went back and I looked at other people and I tried to think of someone else in the role, and I just couldn't. And so finally I went back and I said, "Look, I really want to cast Nicka." So with great reluctance they agreed.
Then you shall have it. By Excalibur, I swear it.
When I told Nicole, I said, "Look, Nicole, I'm going to cast you in the role." And he was, he's a very morose character, really. And he said to me, "Well, who's playing Morgana?" I said, "Helen Mirren." He said, "Well, in that case, I can't be in the film because we did the Scottish play together and it was a terrible disaster and we're not on speaking terms." So when I told Helen that I'd cast Nicko, she said the same thing. "Well, then I can't do it." So since they were there, since they're in the film, our enemies, I thought it was rather a good idea to pit them against each other. And it did give the picture a kind of edge. This is Tintagel. That's all done with effects, of course, prior to the advent of digital effects. And here, Merlin is summoning up the breath of the dragon, the mist that will cover the chasm between the rock where they stand and the castle, so that Uther can ride across it. And this is charm of making that is used throughout the film. Anau Nathrach Uthfas Bethar Docio Diemve is it's Old Irish, actually. And one of the problems I had with Helen and Nicole, as they both insisted on saying it in different ways. And I said, no, it's got to be said in the same way. You know, Morgana learns it from Merlin, so he, you know, she has to say it the same way. But I did it in the end.
We have drawn him out. The Duke is off to pursue your men. There he goes. Good.
In terms of the photography,
I will transform you into the semblance of the Duke.
This scene, you know, the horses in this, in the end, I spent a long time casting the horses because I had to find horses that the actors could handle. If they were, you know, I trained them, I had the actors all training for a long period of time, and if they could, you see, for instance, this scene where the horse has to ride, in this case, in the studio over with dry ice, but the horses had to be extremely obedient, and also they had to be, had to be able to handle them in one with one hand, because the other hand held the lance or the sword. So I used polo ponies, which are trained to neck rein instead of, and so they can stop very on a sixpence, and they can turn quickly, and they can, and this was and the better the actor was at riding, the better the horse I could give him. Gabriel wasn't much of a horseman. And in this scene, we see the death of Cornwall, which is intercut with Uther, as it were, raping his wife. And but he, of course, he's in the guise of Cornwall because Merlin's transposed him. That's the young Morgana, of course. And so people, a lot of people ask me, well, how did you feel about directing your daughter being raped? Well, she wasn't being raped, of course.
My father was dead.
Since it was just a scene. And she
come, Igraine.
She didn't mind, and nor did I. This was a marvellous set designed by Tony Pratt, who has done a lot of my pictures. And in fact, this heavy, monumental kind of Gothic, not Gothic exactly, but Germanic kind of style was very successful, and perhaps more successful than the later Camelot, which was kind of goldy, gold and silver, which I, it was my fault really, I wanted it, and Tony did it, but it wasn't as effective as this. I think the most difficult thing for Katrina in this scene was the proximity of the fire, which wanted to get these flames rising around them. So when we intercut with her husband dying, you had also the flames. I think Nicole's performance in this picture is wonderfully quixotic and quirky and sharp and...
When? Where?
Full of wit and humour.
after nightfall.
It can't be.
Guile.
He came to me, to his bed last night. What shall become of us?
Lord Uther, my lady. It will be for him to say.
Oh, Morgana.
Corin Redgrave playing the part of Cornwall.
The king!
That was a model, of course, of Tintagel. The exterior shot, the model of Tintagel. And the interesting thing about the film, I think, is that it has almost everything in it. It's special effects and models and trick shots of all kinds. I've used a lot of very simple, old-fashioned methods, like aerial image.
Is it mine? Or his?
A man came to me. And loved me. And made this child. I thought it was my husband. But he was already dead.
All I know is how to butcher men. From now on, I shall learn to love them. I'm weary of battle. I shall stay by his side. And his mother's. He's hungry. Merlin, you come when you're not asked, and pay no heed when I call you.
Oh, I have slept for 9 moons.
What I did for you wasn't easy.
Now you must pay me. The child is mine.
This is a kind of crucial part of the legend, is when Merlin comes and takes the baby away, which has been promised to him.
Words, Merlin. This is
as
blood.
Payment for having
is this true?
Allowed Uther to get to Egraine. And the heart of the legend is, and most, and many, many ancient myths, of this notion of the founder of the child turns out to be a prince who is chosen, who's to be king, to be a leader.
To kill and be king? Is that all?
Perhaps not even that.
You strike me with words hard as steel.
You betrayed the Duke. You stole his wife. You took his castle. Now no one trusts you. You're not the one, Uther. Give me the child. I will protect him.
In the Alex's Thompson's photography, what we decided to do was to that was a red complete accident. That this baby just grabbed hold of Katrina's hair as the baby was taken away. It was an incredible moment, of the child clutching its mother's hair.
That's it. Sleep.
This is the young Morgana, who is to grow up to be Ellen Mirren. I wonder what's become of her. She must be in her 20s now. All the forests are really within a mile or two of my own house in Ireland, where there's some ancient primeval oak forests that I was able to use.
Attack!
This particular scene was shot near where I'm recording this now, in Bray. He made all this armour out of aluminium, actually, aluminium. And, what it must have been extraordinary to use this without, when it's made of steel, it must have been great. This sword Excalibur, I had this made by Wilkinson Sword, made it for me. It's a beautiful sword. I have it at home. And I also have the Holy Grail on my mantelpiece. This is Kilruddery, if anybody's interested. Kilruddery, this place is called, where we shot this part.
Merlin! Where are you?
And now, in the next cut, we go to a different location. Here, this is the Childers Wood, which is an oak forest, just not more than half a mile from my home. The scene when the sword comes up rises in the lake. In order to get a kind of very special effect on that, we devised a catapult which was detonated by a charge, so the sword came out of the water at tremendous speed, and we shot it with an ultra high speed camera, 150, 175 frames per second. Nigel Terry makes his appearance, of course, as the part of Arthur. Nigel, it is an extraordinary role, I think. He, after all, plays the part from the age of 16 to Arthur as an old man with tremendous conviction. And he's an extraordinary actor who hasn't done as much as I would have expected in the intervening years. These jousting, you see, this is where the polar ponies come into their own. Most horses will actually shy away from each other, whereas the polar ponies are trained to ride up close to their opponents. So they're extremely adept at this.
I remember my first joust. It looks far worse than it feels.
Now,
of
course, nobody can watch this actor now without thinking of Star Trek.
By my right,
but when I cast him in here, he was simply a good Shakespearean actor who'd never been to Hollywood in his life. When we made the picture, it was really five months of shooting. And it rained every single day. We were always scratching around waiting for a little bit of sunshine, or much of it is shot in dull light, which suits certain sequences. But there were moments when we needed sun, and we had to wait for them. Now, you would notice here and there, you'll see a glint of green light reflecting in the armour. And what Alex Thompson did was to have... we used green light when we were in the forest, not so much here in this scene, but later you might notice that the moss, for instance, in all the forest scenes, we actually lit them, even though we're in daylight, exterior daylight. We did big lamps with green filters on them, so we had green light onto green, giving it a luminous quality. We were trying throughout, actually, to get a kind of luminosity to the picture. You see here this sort of backlight. There you see a green light in the distance. A green
Father, I'll go and see what's keeping you.
Well, hurry, you'll miss your chance.
You know, this is part of the legend, the accidental way in which Arthur just pulls the sword out of the stone. And you see the green light reflected on the sword. And you see the green light on the armour there. We constantly introduce this to give it a kind of magical luminosity.
No, I didn't. Arthur did.
The sword!
You freed it, Arthur?
I did, Father. I beg your forgiveness.
You must put it back.
The sword is drawn. The sword!
The sword!
The sword! The sword!
Now, try to draw it again, Arthur.
Wait! I, Urien, will side. Stand back!
The horseman on the right there is Kieran Hines, who has subsequently become one of the most powerful actors around. He's as with Gabriel Byrne, there he is on the right, as with Gabriel Byrne and Liam Neeson, this was their first picture. It started a lot of people off on their careers, this film.
Rise, Father, please. I was your son before I became your king. If I am king.
You are king. The more so because you're not my son. And I am not your father.
Not my father? Then Kay is not my brother?
So during the shooting of this whole sequence, I could almost go home for lunch. I was only just round the corner. And it's an oak wood I deeply cherish. There are patches of these primeval oak woods all around Wicklow. Like everything is rapidly diminishing, but I've attempted to plant a lot of oaks on my own land, try to recover a little bit of the oak forest that is.
You are King Arthur.
The forest is.
We haven't forgotten you. What trickery!
It's so important to this myth, and to all British myths, really, because the whole land was covered in trees, covered with oaks. And what interested me particularly is really the way in which this legend is about the coming of Christianity and the passing of the old gods. So the Merlin represents the magic of the past. And indeed, the way in which human beings connected to nature and how with the coming of civilization, that there was a loss of that magic, loss of that magical connection to nature and to the old gods of the past. You know, and the advent of a new spirituality, the individual, the coming of man, man's world. And I always had the fear when I'm making a film of someone getting get hurt or killed, you know, for this. And fortunately it's never happened to me. And even doing some pretty difficult stunts in this picture, we never had more than a sprained ankle or a few bruises. See the bluebells here. That I shot this. Indeed, a lot of the picture shot it. You know, we shot it from about March down to through the summer, and I caught the bluebells as they were coming into flower, and later on the apple blossoms. The scene's very much about the spirit of the forest. Of all that it contains. And so I found this spot, which is near Loch Dan, which has a very tangled quality. And this fallen timber, this fallen tree here covered with moss, was actually in the Hamilton Wood. And I still walk in that wood very often. Now, when you come to the night scene here, this is in the studio.
What are you afraid of?
And we actually took that fallen tree, brought it into the studio to play the night scene. Now, you might wonder why. But the thing is that at night,
where is it?
It is everywhere. It is.
We needed control with all these animals and creatures, and we could do so in the studio, whereas had we done it on location, we couldn't have lit it and controlled it in this way.
How can I? What should I? Must I?
Do nothing. Be still. Sleep. Rest in the arms of the dragon. Dream.
Excalibur! It's part of the dragon, too!
Oh, yes. Oh, you learn quickly. That's good. I like that.
Merlin, what kind of man was my father?
Oh, he was brave. He was strong. He was a great knight.
Was he a great king?
Well, he was rash. He never learned how to...
See, Nicholls' performance is exactly what I was trying to achieve, really, was this mixture of fakery and real magic, of humour and cynicism, you know, and of melancholy and sprightliness. This kind of man-woman, this creature whose time is passing.
You couldn't? You are the king, not I.
But where to start?
Well, what do you think has happened since you ran off?
Sir Ector and Kay.
And
they must be waiting.
You see,
for this
I talked about the rain, it raining every day, and of course, what this achieves, what this gives you in Ireland, is this brilliant green, this vibrant colour. But the price you pay for it is that you suffer this constant rain.
There they are.
Break your heart shooting a picture exterior in Ireland.
You go and show them.
But you have to say that it's worth it in the end.
I knew you wouldn't fail us.
Go on.
I picked out a horse for you.
All these men are loyal. Now, what do you want us to do?
I waited here for you. Was that right?
Any man.
One of my biggest problems was preventing the crew from trampling down the vegetation. This is always the issue, because I was always looking for these pristine moments, and I picked out all these locations very, very carefully long before we ever shot the picture. I cordoned them off. I made sure that nobody would go near them, so that they'd have this primal quality. And of course then some prop man blunders into it just before you're about to shoot. This was particularly true when I was with the bluebells.
Get the hook!
This is one of the very few locations. This is a castle. Caer Castle. In Ireland. And it was pretty much the only location that we had. All the other castles and palaces were all... We all built them. Obviously, we had to build all these structures around it and all these siege devices. One of these wooden structures fell down on Nicole's head during this sequence, and knocked him cold. I mean, he was a bit of a hypochondriac. Whether he was actually not cold or just fell dramatically, you know, took a dive, I don't know. But when I suggested putting someone else in his costume to do a long shot, he suddenly made a miraculous recovery. So we put all this structure in over this castle for this struggle. And some fledgling Irish stuntmen who did a lot of this work, who have subsequently formed themselves into an organisation and done very well over the years in Ireland. Phil Hobbs was the swordmaster. He was organised the fights, and the idea was always, you know, to build the character into the fights. The way in which a man fought would demonstrate his character. I tried to, you know, I was very committed to the Irish film industry, and I tried to make film as far as possible with an Irish crew. At that time, it was difficult to put a crew together that was skillful in Ireland. Today, there are several extremely skillful crews. I've just finished a picture, making a picture here myself after a number of years, and the level of skills has risen sharply. At the time, I felt I was... A little bit. I was dragging everybody along with me.
What's this? What's this?
So this moat, this is the reason I chose this castle, because of this moat, which was important to the story and the siege.
In the name of God,
he was wet and he was cold.
I give you the right to bear arms,
that water. They stood in it for hours.
I will solemnly obey.
The black smoke, I have to admit that you know, the best black smoke of all comes from burning old tyres. And shamefully, I have to admit that we left a pall of black flecks over this pleasant little town after this sequence. That moment they had to all had to kneel in the water was somewhat resisted by some of the actors. Sherry Lange has a great sort of pert charm, and she's able to play that sort of innocence and at the same time a kind of sexuality.
You'll have to stay still and rest.
And of course she betrays Arthur with his best friend. And she was able to do that in a certain... In a certain way that kept our sympathy for her. Just behind them there is my second, another daughter of mine, Telsha. And there we see Liam Neeson for the first time. I cast Liam because I saw him on the stage playing the part of Lenny in Mice and Men.
A king must marry after all.
So it seems. I love her. If only she'd be my queen. Merlin, can you make her love me?
This is a speech that for some reason Nicole couldn't get. He kept going up in his lines here. And when that happens, it usually means there's something wrong with the lines. With a good actor like this, and my instinct is if an actor keeps going up on his lines, it's to change them in some way. But Nicole insisted that the lines were good. It was him. And he got it in the end.
Huh? Oh, Guinevere.
This music was had vestiges of medieval music in it. I mean, who knows what period it is. I mean, I wasn't really interested in a period. This is a mythic story. I wasn't interested in trying to specify a period. And so... I used a mixture. I used a lot of Wagnerian music, and largely because I'd just before making the picture, I'd gone to Bayreuth to see the Wagner festival, and I'd been so overwhelmed.
What's in them?
And also that Wagner had dealt with these myths himself, the Tristan and Isolde myth, which is pretty similar, and so there was something so powerful about his music that seemed to relate to what I was doing.
Do you really know?
And then, of course, it's too late.
Too late.
have won battles against
the scene
army.
We shot at for the waterfall. In Enniskerry, County Wicklow, that was once visited by Queen Victoria at a time of a drought, and she came to see the waterfall, and there was no water, so they had men up there with big buckets and barrels of water, which they had to hurl over the side when she appeared. Now, Merlin gets a fish out of the stream here, and we were ready to shoot this scene. We put some stones under the surface, making a little trap to keep the fish in, and the fish were late arriving, and a man called Roderick O'Connor was to bring the fish, and everyone was waiting with him. He was totally panicked. He came running up with the fish and hurled them into the river, and they just swam away. He didn't put him into the little trap. So we built this bridge, of course. And this is where Lancelot challenges all the knights of King Arthur.
I am king! And this is the Excalibur! Sword of kings from the dawn of time! Who are you? What do you seek?
I am Lancelot of the Lake, from across the sea. And I have yet to find a king worthy of my sword.
That is a wild boast. You lack a knight's humility.
Not a boast, sir, but a curse. For I have never met my match in joust or duel.
Overside!
I will not. You must retreat, or prove your worth in the test of arms under the eyes of God.
Here's the reflections of the waterfall in the, apparently a waterfall in the sword. Those are all things, all reflections that we were superimposing, not afterwards, but at the time, by using reflectors and so forth. There's a jousting scene in which there's a very good stuntman called Bronco, who seems to have a very high threshold of pain. He took a lot of falls in the picture, and I just saw him the other day. I said, I'm astonished that you're still alive, Bronco. That was Bronco's fall, though. The odd thing is, you know, that I tried on the armour quite a lot, and of course if it's made to fit, and it had to be, because you can imagine, a suit, if a suit doesn't fit, it's one thing because it's made of loose material, but if the armour absolutely has to fit precisely, and when it does, it is very protective, and I rode those horses quite a lot myself, and did rehearsals, and actually took a fall in armour, and it does protect if it fits properly. And oddly enough, when I was in a full suit of armour, I felt incredibly protected. You feel incredibly safe. You feel for the first time in your life that you are invulnerable
against the knight who is not your enemy. For a stretch of road you could
easily, they were tanks, these men.
So be it. To the death.
The problem with this fight here, which is quite an elaborate one for Bell Hobbs, was to try to show. I mean, we're showing that Arthur is fighting out of anger, and that Lancelot is fighting out of a kind of cool skill. So there was a story to tell within the fight. I mean, that's the issue, is always to say, well, what is the story we're telling here? What are the steps during the course of the story?
Hey!
So the setting is always so important to a scene. Setting, I always try and find a setting that will express the emotion of the scene. Whether it's a set, a building, or a location that you find. Here's the green reflection once again. And out of this anger, he breaks the sword. As the man says, what could not be broken has been broken. And Arthur realizes that his anger has destroyed this sword Excalibur. And Merlin is in despair. Now this water here was extremely cold.
My rage broke it.
And when we, as the lady of the lake,
fairness and grace,
repairs the sword and gives it back to Arthur.
I used Excalibur to change that verdict.
I had to
for all time,
get someone to
the ancient sword of my father's,
lie down under the water
unite all
and
men.
The hand to rise up and give it, give the sword back. So nobody volunteered, so I got my daughter Tersha to do it. And she lay under the water for a long, many long minutes.
The lady of the lake.
She could hold her breath very well.
Take it! Excalibur. Is it true? Take it quickly!
It's a mixture of shots. That was a superimposed shot. This is the actual shot of Tersha under the water with the sword, wearing this extraordinary costume. See the green reflection again on the armor. Green light. Sword is restored
to
him.
Thanks be to God, you're alive.
And you can make friends.
Aye. The best knight in the world bested. This is a great day. For my search is over.
You know, there's something
make me your
about this kind of story. When I was trying to make it, and it was great resistance to it. And eventually, once it was made, it set in train a whole slew of films, a sort of sword and sorcery pictures that followed in its wake. And in a way, you have to, you know, you can make fun of it if you want to, because there's obviously a kind of silliness about it. Perhaps this was a very important scene, very difficult to shoot. That sky has been put in. We shot it during dusk. The sky was superimposed on that wide shot. This was night for night. This is shooting at night on a little hilltop. And I couldn't afford a crane, so you'll see in a moment crane shot, which is done by, we built a ramp and had the cameraman walk up the ramp with the holding the camera, which a steady cam actually. This is the shot. You see, rising up. And although it seems a lavish film and there's armor and large numbers of extras and effects and so forth, it was actually shot pretty much on a shoestring.
Great gladness. Remember it always. For
you are joined by it.
You are one.
Under the stars.
This is, I kind of modeled this scene after the Henry V Agincourt speech.
This great victory.
And throughout the film, there are these little echoes, you know, of...
I was there that night with Arthur.
Give it resonance.
For it is the doom of men that they forget.
Merlin, your wisdom has forged this ring.
Now, you see here... The transition with Nigel Terry into this
to hear and tell of deeds
air of authority and force, which how it contrasts with the boy, you know, the young boy, how he sets out. It's really very underestimated, this performance, I think, at the time.
And the land will have an heir to wield Excalibur. Knights of the Round Table.
The stars, of course, we put in afterwards. There. I was asked why I didn't shoot it in CinemaScope and scope as opposed to... And the reason was one of economy, actually. I mean, I love scope and I've shot many pictures in scope. And, because there were a lot of special effects here, and they were more difficult to do at the time, they were more difficult to do in anamorphic than they were with spherical lenses. So I had to compromise on that because for that reason. This was shot also in Childers Wood, which we waited pretty much all day to get this little bit of sun on these beautiful shots of Guinevere being escorted to her wedding by Lancelot.
Ask you if any one of them could win your heart.
I'm a fighting man. I'm sworn to the quest.
Surely, there must be some lady somewhere in the world who inspires you.
There is one.
Who is she? Oh, go on, tell me.
You?
Oh, you're teasing me.
I will love you always. I will love you as my queen. And as the wife of my best friend. And while you live, I will love no other.
One of the problems with the armor, well, particularly Lancelot's armor, which is silver, was, it was so reflective that if you weren't careful, you saw the camera and the whole crew in it. And this wedding scene was particularly a problem because the reflections in the armor were a nightmare, really. And also, every time it rained, it was sprinkled with rain, we had to rub them down because otherwise you'd see these spots of rain on the armour. It was a huge problem. And that wedding dress of Guinevere was made...
Jesus Christ.
It was made of tiny, tiny beads, handmade. It was an incredible dress and... I had numerous requests from young brides who wanted to know where they could get one like that. And we introduce here Morgana, Helen Mirren, who is a remarkable actress, I think, of great power. I already I spoke about the kind of conflict between these two characters, Helen Mirren and Nicola Williamson, who'd had this very unsuccessful relationship in the past, which I think wasn't only of a professional nature. And they brought this conflict with them, and there was a certain edge which only worked in our favour, I think.
What is the stone that
burns? A look at that, those two cloaks. I think hers is like the bark of a tree.
Mandrake. The essence of it can prolong the act of love.
And if too much is taken?
Pain and death. That's it.
Ooh, you do know something of the art. Do you have the sight? Do you see the future?
Sometimes I dream of things that come to pass.
Look now. What do you see? What will be?
Well, the accents... We didn't go for a particular kind of accent, really. Nicole, you know, this is the way that he speaks. He has this way of... he finds more... he finds more sounds within a single word than anybody else I know.
Yes, to know too much. Lacrimae mundi, the tears of the world.
But the power, the joy.
Moments, fleeting moments.
I can ease your loneliness. Let me help you. Teach me.
Ah, the days of our kind are numbered. The one God comes to drive out the many gods. The spirits of wood
All these things, like that monument there, that figure, were designed by Tony Pratt. Tony Pratt and I have worked together really on and off since 1967. And he is a wonderfully inventive and creative designer. And he makes tremendously fast sketches, and we sit down for days and weeks. Look, you must see those bluebells. I mean, I struggled so hard to get the schedule to work so that we could shoot those things in bluebells. All the seasons were so important to this, the sense of nature, the sense of the passing of nature, the change of seasons. Here again you see this mossy green feeling that is gives it a heightened reality.
Run home to your mother.
A magical, mythic feeling. You notice at the end of the film we don't say no rabbit was killed in the making of this film. So, you know, Lancelot finds this kind of foolish boy who insists on following him, and Percival, who's the kind of fool. There's always this this character in these myths. And now there you see Camelot. Now that you see the Camelot there is. Now I achieved that by aerial image. We just made a little model of the Camelot. Put it down next to the camera with a mirror and reflected it into the lens. It was all done in camera without the use of any kind of optical work. So this we now move into the kind of Camelot pier, which is silver and gold, and I was never really as happy with it as I was with the earlier part of the picture. I don't know if it's totally successful. It's a little bit garish. This was built. This set was built on the back lot of the Ardmore Studios.
Who'll give me my armor and sword?
Kitchen knives and greasy spit shall be your weapons, boy. To the kitchen.
We wanted to give this impression of a kind of, you know, almost a Roman Stay. Thing that they've achieved this table. Power. This strength, this civilization, and to some extent, they're incarcerated by it. They're cut off from nature, from the natural world that they are sprung from. As happens, you know, in civilization, is that the price we pay for knowledge is the loss of perhaps that primal magic.
Sorry, old fella. What are you doing here? This is no place for
Percival the Fool ingratiates himself and into Camelot. And in a sense, you see, he's the he's the boy that Arthur once was, who has this innocence and stupidity.
I must be dreaming.
Get away from there.
The round table was built in sections, and all these scenes were shot in the back lot and in Arbor Studios. We actually, the sets were so big, you know, Tony is always bursting at the seams with his sets, and we knocked out the doors, parts of the walls of the sets to build as the sets expanded out through the. Beyond the confines of the stages.
Lancelot doesn't come once more, but we must fill his cup to show our love.
This is Liam Neeson's first big scene, and the first time he'd been on in a film at all, on camera. And he was, of course, had some scenes with Helen Mirren, and they...
Your eyes never leave me, Merlin.
Fell in love during the film and spent a year or two together subsequently. And Liam was a very boy from north of Ireland, very inexperienced and innocent. And I think Helen was a great teacher to him. I don't mean just sexually, but I mean, you know, she knew everybody and took him around Of course, everyone loved Liam. Everyone wants to.
Then answer me this.
Every woman wants to cuddle him, and many of them do.
Peace has reigned in the land. Crops grow in abundance. There's no want. Every one of my subjects enjoys his portion of happiness.
You see here how we're going for the kind of the golden colour. The reflections are all gold, and the sensuous. Rich feeling that we are trying to achieve.
Where hides evil then in my kingdom?
Always.
But beyond that, you see, beyond that, where he's Merlin's heading for is a kind of green again. You see, he's heading off away from this this place and back into his own milieu.
Where, Sir Gawain?
You know, we made a. In one scene you'll see later when Helen wears a breastplate.
You sit at the round table. Where is this?
And I still have that breastplate at my house. She's
he's our best and our bravest.
With that wasp waist of hers.
Why then is he never here?
And
without
large bosom.
This table is nothing. Is there anyone here?
I saw her the other day, and I'm glad to see that she still had the wasp waist.
By a woman's desire.
And the bosom.
In the idleness that comes with peace, I see that gossip has spread its own evil.
I will forgive your hasty words. Come. Drink from Lancelot's cup and partake of his goodness.
You know, I've spoken about how I'd like to have done it in scope, but did it with flat lenses because of the problem of the optical effects. It'd be much more difficult to do at that time in anamorphic. But also, when it was 80, 81, and when I finished the picture with a Dolby stereo mix, I took it out to the States and we did previews in various places, and I was horrified at how from cinema to cinema the balance was off between the different speakers, and it just terrible. It frightened me, so I came back and did a mono mix on it, so it had a mono mix, this picture. The elements, I hope that we can recover the elements and do restore them. Stereo mix to this edition.
He also stands accused. I decree that at sunrise 2 days from now, the champions will meet and the truth shall be known. For by the law of God, no knight who is false can win in combat with one who is true.
Another example coming up here of an aerial image shot, which is again this little model which we set next to the camera. We set up next to the camera and reflected into the camera through a special mirror, so it superimposes it directly onto the screen. And there you see it. Now,
Lord, we are innocent.
An awful lot of the picture, the effects were done in this way. Here you see this is a Gareth Brown's Lugalore shot, this where he has these extraordinary moss covered boulders, and shot a lot of the picture down there. This is a scene where Lancelot is fighting with himself. It's a dream in which he fights himself. This represents his divided nature, of his loyalty to Arthur and his love for Guinevere. And when he finally vanquishes himself, the armor is hollow. And he then has
Guinevere.
His sword is plunged into himself.
I fight against myself. Oh God!
It was a very simple device with a just stuck the end of a piece of a sword just pushing into his flesh, and then he moves his body in such a way that we don't see it drop away. Very simple. You know that with digital effects, computer-generated effects, the tendency now is for people to say, well, we'll fix that in the computer. Whereas very often these effects can be done in the old-fashioned way, very simply and very inexpensively and effectively. There were a whole lot of good movies made before digital effects were around.
Let me champion the Queen!
Since no knight comes forward, I demand justice.
Here we're coming up to one of the big fights in the picture, where Guinevere lacks a champion, and this young boy Percival
Boy, kneel.
Comes forward to champion her because nobody else believes
in
her.
In the name of God.
Innocence.
Of St. Michael.
And
St. George. I make you a knight. Rise, sir.
Percival.
Percival.
That horse was I bought that horse afterwards. My children rode it for many, many years. It was an old circus horse. Could do anything. My daughters used to ride it standing on his back. This is in the same site where we shot the wedding. It's the Childers Wood, isn't it? And it has and this fight, this is one of the fights that we rehearsed with for weeks beforehand. And you notice that it is very much represents again the nature of the two men and their kind of emotional condition at the time of the fight. The powerful, huge man, Liam Neeson, and Lancelot. Skeleton. And you know the legend was, of course, that with knights was that in combat the truth would emerge. The winner in combat would be the one who had truth on his side. And the fight went through several stages. You know, the joust first of all, and then they're both floored. Then they fight with heavy weapons and swords. You can see the bigger, stronger man and the deft, quicker one. And the problem with these helmets, of course, was that they did, you know, you didn't see the faces, so we had to find an excuse to get to remove the helmets or to see the face in order for the character to emerge. This stand of conifer trees, which are actually not in indigenous,
the Queen is innocent.
But I was tempted to them because they had this kind of cathedral-like quality to them, both for the wedding and for this sequence. They rise up like the pillars in a cathedral, and it seemed very appropriate.
Now, look what they've done.
Save him, Merlin.
He has no will to live.
Bring him back, Merlin, whatever the cost. Whatever the cost, do it.
So be it. Ananadrach, Urthvas Bethad, Dohiel Denby.
Merlin!
This is a perspective corridor. You see, that is only built a few yards deep, and then beyond that, it's just a perspective. It's built in miniatures to give you the sense of this great depth to this corridor here.
Yes.
No riddles, nothing.
See, the set only extends to the pretty much to the end of those.
But a king should be
those
queen.
Candles, and after that,
always.
It's simply a painting.
Everywhere, in the corridors of his castle, on the deer paths of his forest,
or in a more tangled forest. In here.
Well, great.
My lord.
You see these candles at the back there. These are very elaborately made, built with little mirrors to reflect the candlelight. And there was an enormous amount of work in terms of costumes, makeup, headdresses.
We have lost our way.
Went into these scenes. It was a massive job in the morning to get everybody ready for the scenes.
Which is the greatest quality of knighthood? Courage, compassion, loyalty, humility? What do you say, Merlin?
The greatest. They blend. Like the metals we mix to make a good sword.
No poetry, just a straight answer. Which is it?
Yes, Arthur is now in this kind of relaxed, this mode of being the armchair king. He's there he is, sitting in his palace with law and order. And now, you know, the worm, the invisible worm has started to eat away under the edifice because of the betrayal of Guinevere with Lancelot, and everybody knows about it. And this is somehow going to bring about the fall of Camelot. You know, Merlin makes this remark saying that the greatest quality of a knight is truth, because when a man lies, he murders some part of the world. This is also shot at Lugalore, this magical place where my friend, belonging to my friend Gareth Brown, and back amongst these boulders, these moss-covered boulders. And when this picture showed in Cannes, and Gareth was there and he saw Excalibur thrown into his lake, he said, well, does that mean it belongs to me now? This scene is, this was, the set was built in the back lot, and the hills we're looking at beyond there are the Wicklow Hills, and we shot this at sunset, so that's a real sky.
What must I do now?
And
kill them?
But again, you see fire reflected in the in the silver balustrades.
The gods of once again, forever.
Wind, constantly wind blowing, wind machines blowing the fans, blowing the flags, and so that almost all the dialogue was looped afterwards.
To be king alone.
And you, old friend, will I see you again?
It's a very moving scene. I've always found this very touching, this farewell scene between Arthur and Merlin. And Merlin is now passing out of the world, in a sense, because of Camelot, because of the coming of civilization. In science and rationality has taken the place of magic.
Thank you.
wing, snake skin. Is this all you've learned, Morgana, to deal in potions and petty evil?
And where have your meddling arts brought the world? To the edge of ruin.
I'm worn thin and threadbare. I've tried to guide men or meddled in their...
This great cobwebby dress that we made for Morgana here.
Oh, forgive me. Where are you going?
Whence I came.
Merlin, take me with you. The charm of making. You swore to pass it to me.
You think you're ready? Are you worthy?
I am. I am.
Then, follow me.
Now, there were an awful lot of mosquitoes about when we shot this scene. So, I have to... It was quite cold, also. And I have to congratulate those two actors for their... stoicism. This is another great set that Tony Pratt built. A kind of stalactites and stalagmites of all these extraordinary colours. And intercut, of course, with the love scene between Guinevere and lots of suffering... from these terrible mosquitoes.
What is this place?
Here you enter the coils of the dragon. Here my power.
So, you know, faced with what the Merlin's cave should look like in the depths of the earth, you know, maybe we overdid it a bit with the colour, coloured lights.
Desire.
But,
knowledge.
And oblivion.
And of course this is the scene where Merlin is tricked by Morgana and she actually incarcerates him. You know, the legend was that Merlin was trapped in a rock and there he remains to this day waiting to be released. So I devised this kind of elaborate pageant in which the characters step in and out of each other's scenes. And they see elements from the past and...
Show me the dragon. Tell me the sacred charm.
And it's... Merlin's intention is to destroy Morgana here, but as he does so, as he's about to do so, Arthur plunges his sword into the... between the sleeping lovers, and by so doing he foregoes the sword. He loses it and loses his power that goes with it. The power, because the sword represents the power of a king. It's the force of magic, the force of nature that's focused in that sword. And by doing this, I mean, what he's doing is signaling to the two lovers that he's discovered them. He knows what they're doing. And as he plunges it into the ground, Merlin's power is diminished at that moment, just as he's about to destroy Morgana. The sword goes in, and Merlin is the sword passes through Merlin for a moment. We see, and his power is lost. Morgana triumphs. I was slightly embarrassed that this was a little bit panto-ish here with all the smoke and fire and coloured lights. But on the other hand, the scene does have power.
Yes, Merlin, that's it. Set the world to rights.
And then, of course, you know, we try to show how he is kind of ossified by this translucent rock forming around him and incarcerating him. As Morgana chants the charm of making. So we're trying a way of to suggest the crystallization of that smoke crystallizing and gradually incarcerating him. And this was done in an optical effects house by Fred Chandler, who's done an awful lot of my optical effects work over the years. And it was a scene where that I'd like to have done. You know, if I'd had digital effects at that point, I could have done it all in one shot. But you see, it's done in a number of cuts, and we gradually build it up. And this, I like this at the end where you get the refraction. You see several of his faces.
I shall find the man and give birth to a god.
I'm kind of glad to get out of there in the end. I'm still a little embarrassed by those. That's that. There they are, back with their mosquitoes. Being brave. So they wait to discover the sword there and realize that Arthur knows all about it. Which drives Lancelot into madness.
The lamb without a king!
So this is one of the spiciest bits in the legend, where Morgana, in a sense, by it's rather like as Uther and can see himself as Cornwall. This is a echo of that. Morgana turns herself into the image of Guinevere and sleeps with Arthur and conceives.
I could kill you now.
A son.
But I want you to live to see our son be king.
With our model of Tintagel again. This is interesting here. Again, a very simple effect. I had a pregnant woman, a very pregnant woman, about to give birth, and she's lying next to Helen, and Helen's body is down in a false bottom in this bed, so Helen's body is concealed, and the pregnant body belongs to somebody else.
God save us from Morgana. And save us from her unholy child.
I like this shot for its kind of purity. With the whole frame is filled with knights and that absence of colour.
Is he dead?
No, he lives.
Now this is the third phase in the film, the wasteland, so that this has been brought about by the demise of the king, by this sin that's been perpetrated against nature. And this is up in the Wicklow Hills, in the moors there, and shot in, of course, during the winter, when it's bleak and there's no green. So, in order to restore the land,
we must find what was lost.
The king has to be restored. So, in order,
only the
Grail has
to
be found. So he sends the knights out to search for the Holy Grail.
Search the land.
And the opposition, of course, is Morgana, who wants to put her son, Mordred, onto the throne in Arthur's place. And it's extraordinary now how Nigel Terry now is going in, moves into another phase here, the stricken king.
Portents. Signs. Follow.
The king has spoken. I will ride forth in the name of that quest.
We will find this grail or die.
Mara's lake, Lugalore, again, and Camelot superimposed over there, and the knights ride out onto their quest. These are some of the first scenes I shot because we started off in the winter. And obviously everything is shot out of order. These snow scenes we just about managed to capture in March of that year. Scene of finding the dead knight. I really
found it.
Got Red. The side iceberg. I really stole this idea from the Seventh Seal of Bergman. He did it much better. But the bleak and wintry landscape, I think, gave enormous strength to this bleak idea. This whole sequence of the wasteland was quite a bit longer originally. The film is about 2 hours 20 minutes in total, and I cut it down from closer to 3 hours. And I think it is better at this length than it was when it was longer. Some people might feel it better if it was shorter still. That's a very tough stunt to do. And that was again Bronco, who was the double there. And that's my son, Charlie, in that mask there. He was about 12 years old at the time. And he went on to play the lead in The Emerald Forest when he was 17. To give the character a bit more weight and menace, I got his sister Telsha to dub his voice. These, odd enough, I was down there just the other day, this oak tree with the knights hanging from it. There are still bits of rope hanging from it there, from this time. And this shot here, of plucking the crow plucking out the eye, that particular shot was set up in a cage. We set up a cage with these birds in it, and put this sheep's eye in there. And it took, many, many days to get it to work, sitting with a camera, waiting for when they might do it. Still, this is Tin Tatter, as we saw it at the beginning of the film, and when it was Duke of Cornwall and Igraine. And now it's been sort of transformed by Morgana, made more kind of evil quality about it. Again, the coloured lighting is very important. And look at this amazing dress.
The day you have searched.
Is it so long?
And tell me.
All these clothes were made, handmade by seamstresses in Ireland.
Sorrow, death. And I never thought to hear laughter again. that I saw this boy. And he promised me the grail. Is it here?
You have searched too hard. Take your ease. Drink and join with me. There is no grail as these good knights have found. They serve me instead. There are many pleasures in the world, many cups to drink from.
So Morgana has seduced and tempted all these knights into her service.
No good, mother.
And destroyed and the ones who wouldn't.
Take him to the tree.
So here's the knight swinging in the breeze, and the spur saves Percival's life by cutting his rope. And in that moment, he gets this image, this vision of the Grail. There again you see the green light shining onto the green trees, giving that luminous effect. This again was a very simple superimposition effect which we did at the time of the Grail spilling blood.
Is the secret of the Grail? Who does it serve?
My grasp. I failed you.
When am I going to be king, Mother? When the time comes.
We're coming out to this transition here from the young Mordred to the older Mordred, which would have been done as a morph in these days, but there we did it simply by a little trick that she of a fade.
No spear, no sword, no arrow, no lance, no blade, no weapon.
The trick was in the casting, getting the two boys to look very similar.
Will harm you whilst you wear this armor.
Any message for your dear brother, my father?
You are my message.
So Arthur, the sick king, is confronted by the pretender, the son that he bore in such a unfortunate way.
Keep a distance, Mordred.
And this, the boy who played Mordred, was a brilliant rider. He actually was an international rider. And this meant I could give him a terrific horse that that was extremely, that most of the other actors wouldn't have been capable of riding. And it gave his character much, you know, enormous amount of strength.
I cannot give you the land. Only my love.
That's the only thing of yours I don't want. The Quest Knights have failed. They're all dead. You are dead too. I shall come back and take Camelot by force.
Loch Dan, the edge of Loch Dan. You see what she's riding. We see how he brings this horse to a stop.
Curious.
Renounce the king and I'll spare your life. So be it.
Oh. Wait!
I see when Mordred rides up now in this next shot, and for the coup de grace. Magnificent riding. Again, all this shot in the bleak winter time. That's a tremendous contrast with the rich colours of the Camelot period.
I was afraid to help you.
Percival, never give up the quest.
I saw the Grail, Eurynce. It was in my grasp. I failed.
You are.
I always wish I'd darkened his teeth down a bit. His dental work looks too good.
Worthy.
You must. You must.
You know, what I tend to see when I rerun my movies is I just see the flaws, the things I wish I'd done differently. But, I can watch this film. I never really watch my films again once I finish them, unless for some special reason. But Excalibur is a film I can watch because the power of the story, the myth, is outweighs my reservations about the film that I made and how I dealt with it. It's such a powerful story. It grips me in spite of myself, really.
Look at the great.
One of the problems here was that this of course is Lancelot,
but what did they give
him instead? Beard and hair and
vermin and pestilence.
Lancelot.
And the problem was he wasn't really recognizable. I mean, and a lot of people didn't realize it was Lancelot, which rather takes away from the scene. Most of these peasants here are played by the travelling people of Ireland. They were wonderful in the picture. Because they're used to being outdoors, used to hardship. And their faces, you know, have the mark of the weather upon them. This is a very important scene where Lancelot is dragged under by his armour, and in order to, he divests himself, he takes off his armour in order to surface. He strips himself, so he emerges naked, comes up out of the water, cleansed and purified and reborn, in a sense, with an innocence that enables him at last to see the Grail. We shot that in the tank at Ardmore Studios. The underwater scenes, of course.
I can't give up hope, Lancelot. It's all I have.
But again, very simply done, really, which is the Grail transforming itself into the figure.
Have you found the secret that I have lost?
Yes. You and the land.
The notion of the king and the land one is sort of central to this whole myth. And when he takes this and drinks it, what happens is that as he holds it, he takes it across like that, it's all in one shot, and it gradually fills up magically with the liquid, with the elixir.
You and the land are one.
And trailing down, there's a hole through the bottom, and trailing down was a little rubber tube which is with the wine being pumped into it. And, of course, it would have been easy to do on a cut, but such is the vanity of directors, you know, that we'd like to do those kind of things in one shot and amaze anybody who sees it. How did they get the thing developed? But these days, of course, nobody even questions these things. How do they do that? They say, oh, it must have done it on the computer. David Hockney, the artist, said to me, you know... the digital effect is going to mean the end of the movies, because it used to be that whatever we saw on the screen was we knew it, that it had occurred at some point in time and place. Now we can no longer be sure.
Now, my brother,
so films have lost their reality.
God!
You notice he doesn't go too far down the corridor, because it's you know, the set only goes so far, the rest of it is painted.
Prepare for battle!
Oxford Scientific Films, I introduced them to feature film making and with my film Zardoz, and the first thing they did, and I used them on here to get this blossoming effect here, and they did that in their laboratory. The apple blossoms, of course, were all actual. Now they're riding on. This is another scene where I had to wait very carefully for the apple blossoms to come into bloom, and every day I would call down to this orchard to find out were they in bloom, and eventually they were. And this is the notion of the land coming back to life again, springing back to life, and because the king is cured, so the land is cured too. with wind machines blowing the blossoms at the riders. That's an actual castle too. But this, of course, is not. This is a set. You know, the legend itself, of course, has many forms. I mean, we adapted this from the Mort d'Arthur, which is the Sir Thomas Malory's version of it. There are several other versions, von Eschenbach's, for instance. But in the Mort d'Arthur, you know, it was one of the first books ever written down, that is to say, because these are all passed on in oral fashion. But Malory was in prison, actually for rape, as a matter of fact, and he was commissioned by Caxton, who just built this printing press, the first printing press. And of course, he didn't know what to do with the printing press. He would print up the Bible, and then what do you do after that? There weren't any books, really. So he commissioned Thomas Malory to write down the story of the Arthurian legend. And this is what he did. And we really took it from that, although there are elements from other sources too. And of course, we, in the end, Rosper Pallenberg and I, who wrote the script, we invented things. And you, with a legend like this, you have to respect the legend. You're one in a line of storytellers, a long line of storytellers, and each storyteller can take the story and twist it and turn it as long as its essential elements are respected. And this is what I did. I mean, I tried to move it. My interest really was to put it on that cusp of the coming of Christianity and the coming of the notion of the individual. The Christian notion of the individual Christ, the individual man, the rationality. And this idea that she, Guinevere, keeps Excalibur and hides it away is something that we really invented. The idea of putting, of the sword being lost, being placed between the two lovers, was really invented, although you find it in other legends. And I had the feeling when we were doing the script, when we were inventing things, I had the feeling that we weren't inventing them, we were uncovering them, that they were lost elements of the story that we were actually recovering and putting back to rights again. And, you know, you're gripped by this myth. I've known it, I've read all the versions of it, so I feel a part of it, a very, very small, insignificant part of it, and I feel that I'm merely one in a long line of storytellers who have taken this story and told it. Each generation retells these myths. This is my landscape. This is the Wicklow Mountains. This is where I live. And this is where I love this wildness of this landscape. That henge, sort of stone henge, that we built up there on top of that mountain behind them, those pillars are made of polystyrene, and we lifted them in by helicopter, which was the only way we could do it because it's completely boggy up there, but it was a perfect site for it. And that's where I wanted it to be. And it really wasn't that difficult. At least it wasn't that difficult for me. I just stood and watched while they did it. Now, the legend of Merlin having been incarcerated in this rock. So I took this notion and imagined the way in which Arthur could get into touch with Merlin, with the spirit of Merlin. That's my friend Gareth Brown's lake down below there. We're back to Lugnore.
Where are you, Merlin?
The sense is that Merlin's cave is down below this site. Oddly enough, we had this henge up there. I remember going. I was up there one day, we weren't shooting, and just going to have a look at it. We just completed the building of it, and these American drove up in a car, and they were searching their guidebook for some evidence of this extraordinary henge that was up on the top of this mountain. And of course it wasn't in their guidebook because it didn't exist. I was able to put them right.
Your love brought me back. Back to where you are now. In the land of dreams. Are you just a dream, Merlin?
There's nothing an actor likes better than to be killed off and then to come back again in the film.
A nightmare to others! Merlin!
Especially Nico Williamson.
Kay, wake up my brother.
I was dreaming of Merlin.
So they're preparing now for the great battle with the forces of evil.
I dreamed of him too.
And oddly enough, this is the battle in the fog, as we called it. This is the sort of dragon's breath, which he has conjured up once again to conceal the fact that Arthur's numbers are so few and Mordred's are so great. So we set up this whole scene with this night camp where Merlin, the spirit or the shadow of Merlin, passes into Morgana's camp. And there she is. Still as beautiful as ever, despite the years that have passed by. So he's used her magic to keep herself in this state. There's the breastplate that I have in my drawing room at home, standing up against the wall to remind me of the exquisite contours of Helen Mirren's body. I've actually left that to her in my will.
Have you any magic left to do battle with Merlin? Nothing to fear from an old man you vanquished.
Now we have this problem. You see, we've got to age her, and When Merlin destroys her, we have to age her. And again, we used fairly simple devices to achieve this.
A shadow. You must be greater than ever I was. I once released the dragon's breath so Uther could lie with your mother and beget a king. It almost destroyed me. But I expect you can do it quite easily. Couldn't you? I see no mist. Or have your powers faded too? The charm. That's it. Use the charm.
It's a very simple set, really, just made up of some netting and some drapes. And Alex Thompson's good lighting. Partly it's to do with the movement, the camera movement. Now this was simply a little pipe alongside her mouth there. We put alongside her mouth to emit the smoke. It's influenced by her own breath. Just about get away with it.
It can.
And of course she makes this fog, or he causes her to make this fog, which then covers the battlefield and obscures the fact that Arthur has so few men against Mordred's masses.
A fog is rising.
Fog? That cannot be. My mother has a sense for such things. She said there would be no fog.
It will stand against us in battle.
Merlin, where are you? Where are you?
Mother?
My dear, sweet boy.
I hope Helen Mirren never looks like that. I shot this in a big indoor riding school, because obviously there had to be soft earth on the floor, which you have in a riding school, and had to be enclosed so we could keep the smoke in.
Where are they?
And oddly enough, listen, when I was going to work that morning, there was a heavy fog right over the Wicklow Hills. We could have actually shot it on location, but obviously you had to enclose it in order to keep the smoke in, and yet it had to be big enough to have horses galloping around and fighting taking place. This is one of the most difficult scenes. And if you're staging a battle in Ireland with Irish extras, the problem you have is getting them to stop once you get them started. When you call cut, they keep going, settling old scores. And these sort of shots, you know, you do four or five of these shots a day. There's an enormous amount of work involved in them. Getting the smoke right, getting the effects right. The idea was to gradually pin down Arthur and his remaining knights. They're getting beaten, and then along comes Lancelot to help out. And again, I made this slight error, I think, of making him too hairy, so that you didn't exactly recognize him at first. I mean, once you get into the dialogue, you realize who it is. Or, I mean, at least Arthur calls out his name, so we hope that would work. So coming up now, you know, this level of, this tone, the level of reality in the film is always on the edge. There are times when it moves into this mythic dimension. In this final scene that's coming up, we have this great sort of sun rising through the mist. And this is done with a... It's clearly kind of artificial. It's done with a piece of a disc of 3M reflective material with a lamp shone into it, which is through a mirror in the camera. And the idea is to get a kind of Götterdämmerung, a kind of twilight of the gods effect. Not a naturalistic effect at all.
Come, Father. Let us embrace at last.
This is the sun. And this is a kind of tableau here with the death. Arthur killing his son. Against the red glow of the sun. With Excalibur. So we're in another world.
Excalibur. Find a pool of calm water. Throw the sword into it.
No.
Obey me, Percival. Do it and return.
And this is, you know, always, this is one of the important parts of the legend, one that I wouldn't tamper with, which is that the idea that Arthur instructs Percival to throw Excalibur back into the lake, and reluctantly he goes off to do what he's told. There's always this notion of truth and loyalty comes into the legend. He drives off, he rides off and back to the back again to Lugalore once more. And there he just can't bring himself to throw the sword into the lake. And he goes back to Arthur and lies. Arthur asked him what he saw. And this is a line straight out of the Mor Dhapa. He says, all I saw was the wind on the water. So, the fog has lifted now, and we see that we're close to the edge of the sea. This part of I shot down in Derrynane and Kerry. And waited there, oddly, ironically, went down there, and there was a thick fog set in. We couldn't see a thing, couldn't shoot. Sat there for 3 days with 120 people, horses, armor, people, actors, trying to get the shots. At the end of a long, long shoot.
One day, the king will come, and the sword will rise again.
Tells him to go back to do it. Properly throw the sword into the lake. There you see those little islands off the coast of Kerry. Meanwhile, back at the lake, finally he, Percival, throws it in. And this shot was done with a series of tricks, really. The shot coming up a bit, sailing through the air as the hand rises. There's my daughter again. Then this is shot against blue screen, spinning. It comes down, that shot in reverse. So we just plucked it away from her hand and reversed it, the camera. The sun is superimposed there, of course.
Arthur!
Now, this shot was actually done against front projection. So, the previous shot was done against front projection of him riding up to it. And this was a boat we built, of course. It was a proper boat. And the three queens who were to escort the body of Arthur to the land of Avalon, which is the land of the apple. When I finally finished the film, after so many years of struggling to make it, and the 2-3 years it took actually to do it, I felt not a sense of anticlimax, but a sense that a burden had been lifted from me. It was as though this was a kind of destiny that I had to make this picture, and having done it, I felt my burden was lightened. I felt a sense of release, really. I got Trevor Jones to write the music. You see, really, I have to say that I was working on a very tight budget. And so I couldn't afford a big composer. Trevor Jones was a young composer, never done a film score, but I heard about him. I listened to some of his music. I thought he was terrific. He was South African. He came from what's called the Cape Coloured South Africans, and won a scholarship to go to England to study. We worked very, very closely together for a long time to make the score, and much of his stuff was very good. But I'd been influenced so much by going to see the Wagner Festival in Bayreuth that I just felt the Wagner music was so important to this that I put some of it in, and some of the music is Trevor's and some of it belongs to Wagner. I'll tell you, it was, you know, tremendously exhausting to make the picture. You know, I was producing it as well as writing it and directing it. And at the end of it, we took it, you know, to the States to preview it. Finally, it opened up. And I went to see it in Westwood in Los Angeles, a college audience. I went along with the Orion people. It was Mike Medavoy and Arthur Krim. They'd been on for some weeks, and the audience were chanting out the charm of making, Anal, Nathrak, Usfas, Bethard, Dokeo, Diemve, and calling out the dialogue and lines, and it was an extraordinary experience. It suddenly completely transforms the film, and it's how it should be with this kind of story. The audience should be part of it.